Maximize cloud efficiency with Doit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Visit doit.com. That's doit.com. Doit, your cloud simplified.
Packet pushers.
Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, you amazing human. You today, we're going to talk about regulated medical connected devices. I know that's a lot of words I strung together, but the long and short of it is you might have a pacemaker that's connected via Bluetooth to your phone that's connecting to the cloud. And my goodness, that's a lot of potential failure points. So how do you handle all of that? And we're not going into this conversation alone. We have two excellent guests, Kyler. We have Randy Horton. He's the Chief Solutions Officer at Orthogonal. They write software that does this sort of thing. And Ian Sutcliffe, who's an AWS worldwide tech lead for healthcare and life sciences. So he knows a thing about a thing when it comes to this. What stuck out to you in the conversation, Kyler?
I mean, most of it, because I have exposure to medical, but not to devices. And I found that fascinating. We learned about how clocks skew based on electricity frequency. So thank you, Ned, for that factoid. And I also learned a lot about how Orthogonal works with AWS and Ian to move fast and hopefully break nothing in this highly regulated medical device industry.
Yeah, it was a fantastic episode. So please enjoy this episode with Randy Horton and Ian Sutcliffe. Well, Randy, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Very excited to have you here. You raised your hand and said, I have a thing to talk about. But before we get to that, can you tell us a little bit about you? Who are you? What do you do, Randy?
Sure. So I'm the Chief Solutions Officer at a software development consultancy called Orthogonal. It's based out of Chicago, although I'm about an hour north of Miami myself. My unofficial title, but this is not an industry in med tech where you can have cheeky business titles like VP of Happiness. My unofficial title is Chief Extrovert Officer, CXTRO. And Orthogonal is a software development consultancy. We got into this business to improve patient outcomes faster. The way we do it is by helping medical device companies build three kinds of software, which we can get into a little bit later if you want. Software as a medical device, connected device systems, you know, think insulin pumps or glucose monitors, and digital therapeutics, essentially prescription software. The way we accelerate things is basically by bringing the best of modern software engineering and product management methods from the things you guys discuss every week on your podcast, and merging those with the medical device industry's traditional and regulated focus on keeping things very safe and stable.
We're going to dig into the concept of a regulated device in a moment, but I want to give Ian a chance to introduce himself as well. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the podcast. Who are you and what do you do?
Hi. Thanks for having me, Ian. It's good to be here. So my name is Ian Sutcliffe. I am a principal solutions architect and tech strategist at AWS, and I'm focused on the healthcare and life science industry vertical. Been at AWS just over 5 years now, based out of Switzerland. Nice country to live in if you can get it. But prior to AWS, I was actually working in the industry. So I've worked in both pharmaceutical and medical device companies. You know, and working at one of those is when I really got into cloud and started to see the benefit of how cloud could really help these industries. That's when I made the jump. So I started as a techie. You know, I was a developer. I loved the, you know, I hate to say it now, but the internals of Windows was where I started. So real low-level stuff. Became a solutions architect, then enterprise architect, and yeah, then moved over to AWS.
That's fantastic. And I understand you are both here to talk about some regulated medical devices. So let's start with what that is, because Ned and I have never worked with medical devices. So what are those? What are the implications for infrastructure engineers who have to support them?
It's a whole spectrum of medical devices, but I think what we're focused on here is really, you know, how the software angle of that fits in. So you've seen physical medical devices, they have firmware embedded in them. So that's software in a medical device. You actually have a software that itself is a medical device, so there is no physical. So the latest examples are, you know, machine learning models, which can look at an MRI scan and help, you know, come up with some diagnosis. That's software as a medical device. And then you've kind of got the bit in between, which is connected medical devices. So you have a physical device running firmware. It's often connected through some kind of connectivity, IoT usually, to a cloud backend or on-premise backend. So we have those connected devices as well. Now, all of these are, of course, have the potential to negatively impact patient safety, or, you know, you don't want these things going wrong. So that's why they're regulated by agencies such as the FDA. So that's why it's a regulated medical device.
You can think about it instead of Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. With great power comes great regulation when it comes to physical devices that can operate on the human body for diagnosis, monitoring, and therapeutics of just about anything.
When I think about the potential for issues, if I have a device that I'm relying on to keep me alive or provide a treatment to me, the fact that it has to connect off to something else makes me a little nervous, makes me a little twitchy. Like, I want everything local so I don't have to worry about a failure mode outside of this device. Randy, you're writing the software for these devices. How do you deal with those concerns of devices that depend on the cloud or some external service to provide whatever they're doing?
So it's a very interesting conundrum. It's not brand new, but the cloud and also consumers bringing their own smartphones and AI and these things, sort of distributed computing essentially, has really thrown a couple interesting curveballs at our industry. As we like to say, first of all, move fast and break things is a terrible idea in our space, because if you move fast and break something with a medical device, the thing you're breaking is a human body. And I think the really scary thing out there, you know, which I'm sure has been in a movie or two, is if somebody moves fast and breaks things with connected devices and somebody harms human beings at scale, which is what we're all working to avoid. Because what we all want to do, so to speak, is move faster and break nothing. That's actually our coder credo that we have printed on the back of our hoodie sweatshirts. Because people do want to move at software speeds and not hardware speeds, because you can improve patient outcomes faster. So we're really, really strong on change control, because as I would say to you, like, think about, somebody says, why do you have so much change control? Well, think about your last build for whatever app you were building. Okay. Was it good? Yeah, it was good. Okay, good. Give me the code, because I'm going to put it in your grandma's pacemaker right now. It's like, well, hang on. Well, why? Because, well, I might want to test it again. I'm like, and there you have it. That's the wanting to test it again. So the point is, I mean, think about it. If your grandmother is a connected pacemaker that does talk to the cloud and send some data back, would you rather that back end be in a proprietary data center, bare metal, built by a device manufacturer, or would you rather it be on, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, or Google's cloud?
That is a tough call. I guess it depends on the expertise of the device manufacturer. Do they focus on building highly resilient data centers?
They focus on pacemakers, and now they've got cloud back ends. Who do you think is going to be more secure?
I'm concerned. I'm concerned with that framing. So I think you've achieved your goal here. When, like, Slack goes down, I cheer because I get to go get a coffee. But if a pacemaker stops working or an insulin pump stops working, that's much more concerning.
So generally speaking, you're more likely to trust the security, the stability, the spare AC parts, you know, for a broken air conditioner with a major cloud service provider than any company, no matter how good they are, that's not a cloud services provider. On the other hand, how often do you want me to update the code in grandma's pacemaker?
Not very often, only when absolutely necessary.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. But how often does Amazon change code or make configuration changes? Ian, what's the count?
It's a lot. I don't have an exact number, but it's a lot. I mean, across the number of services we have is 200 plus now. Any point in time, you know, we're continually trying to improve each of these services, whether that's net new features, new services, just improving the internals. You know, change is a constant when it comes to operating in the cloud, but that's perceived as a good thing. You want the latest, greatest features, you're going to get them very quickly through the use of cloud. But you're going to have that change, and you need to manage that change. You need to assess the risk of that change. What's the impact? Now, usually, you know, net new features that you're getting out of the box, you're not using them yet anyway, so it's not going to typically have an impact on your device. And then the focus changes towards, you know, change management of those, you know, small changes. Is your cloud provider applying a lot of small changes or one big change? You know, so a big change is typically higher risk, because you never know what in that change actually broke something. So if you're applying a lot of very little changes, the ability to detect regression during that change is much easier, and you can back it out very quickly. So, you know, there's all these things. And as you're assessing your cloud service provider, you need to look at how do they manage change. That's kind of the crucial topic in any of these regulated industries, is change management. So look at your cloud provider, how they apply change, how automated is it, how rigorous is the testing. You know, to Randy's point, if there's a change coming down the pipe, you know, there's always that, you know, from a device perspective, let's just test once more, just in case. So how many tests does any change go through as it you know, traverses down the pipeline towards, you know, it's going to hit your production environment. You know, when you're in the cloud, the only thing that distinguishes dev from prod is your tagging of an account. You're using the same services. The changes apply to everywhere. It's an interesting conundrum for device manufacturers around how to deal with this constant change.
You're essentially buying it for the change because it's more secure, right? You're going to get patches in sooner than anybody else. But simultaneously, you don't get a chance generally, except for maybe major changes, you know, with sort of a pre-release, you don't get to pre-run it. So the second that change happens at the cloud services provider, it's essentially in the human body, right? It's out there. And so you can monitor things post, which is part of our big advocacy is, you know, do a lot of really good regression testing in production, which by the way, is just a good cloud best practice anyway. Just be really good at testing automation and just run all the time. But that's a shift for our industry because we're used to saying, no, nobody touches this castle with a moat around it until we are certain that we are comfortable with the change. And the guidance we're working on is through an organization called the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, AMI. They've been around a very long time. They're sort of the preeminent standards creator in the medical device space. And a lot of what they do is in collaboration with, you know, with the FDA and other national regulators. And it's been coming to this answer of, okay, we can admit there's a different thing. We do not have direct control. We have indirect control through a contract and service level agreements. But let's all raise our hands and say, okay, I don't have direct control, but that's okay. As long as I understand that and do a good design and architecture and risk mitigation plan so that I'm using things in a smart way and not just throwing everything over the cloud if sometimes that situation is not acceptable for risk.
I guess I'm of two minds about hosting it yourself versus trusting in a cloud provider to do it. And part of that is centered around, I know that the regulations can be very stringent and there's sort of a shared responsibility model when it comes to the public cloud, but ultimately it falls on your shoulders, Randy, like you're the one who's regulated.
Yeah, legally the buck stops with us, not with Ian.
Exactly.
The lawsuit might stop with Ian, but the legal accountability stops with us.
Right, so bearing that all in mind, I would side with, I want to control everything myself. I want to be in full control, soup to nuts, of the bare metal all the way up to the services that are running, because I'm also being held responsible by the regulated industry. So how do you square that with, yes, AWS or any other cloud provider does tons of testing and they have the experience around managing infrastructure at scale?
That's the differentiate, is that we've gained that experience of operating at this, you know, huge scale. Very few companies out there can claim to have done the same, you know. So there's a lot of learning. We've built out this, you know, huge, you know, global infrastructure. We've built services on top of that. It's our core business. If things go wrong, and things always go wrong, hardware breaks for you, whether you're on-premise or in the cloud, it's going to break at some point. I think it was Werner Vogel's always said that it's not, you know, if something breaks, but when, you know, and that's universal. But we've learned from that. So we've got that physical infrastructure, but we've built services to be resilient. So simple example, if you store objects in your S3 bucket, under the hood, it's actually replicating that across multiple AZs, availability zones. So the chances of any one object being lost is something like 1 in a billion. It's, you know, 11 nines durability for this service. So the cloud and the services it's providing is providing such levels of resiliency based off our learnings. Now imagine trying to build that yourself in your own data center. You know, we've all worked for companies that have maybe an AB plus C DR strategy. So you've got two rooms in a data center with separate power supplies and, you know, try and separate it to give high availability. Then you have a geographically distant site C, which is for your DR, you know, and, you know, that's sitting empty or redundant, you know, it's just ticking over, it's not doing anything and it's costing you money. Now compare that to being resilient in the cloud. So you mentioned the shared responsibility model. It's not just we take care of this security and compliance of the cloud, you do it in the cloud, but it's also your architecture design, this resiliency. So we're creating services that are designed to be resilient. But you can then define your architecture on top of that. So if you want multiple availability zones for a highly available architecture, that's up to you to do. You stick it in one AZ, that's up to you too. If you want to, you know, cater for the, you know, everything's risk management with devices, you know, the risk of an entire region disappearing. You know, if the West Coast of America has an earthquake and drops into the ocean, you know, you've lost all your availability zones. Very slim risk, but you have the option to have cross-region replication, you know, and you know, your DR site could be in a different region entirely through infrastructure and code. You can then spin up that DR site. You know, there's lots of flexibility and ways to deal with risk that just wasn't available on premise.
And I think the recognition is now there. You know, 15 years ago, what was the line with cloud? We can't go to the cloud. You don't know if it's secure. And right now it's like, you can't not be in the cloud. Otherwise, how do you know that you're secure? And we've seen this evolution with regulators and with the government, right? I mean, look, NSA, I believe, has an unlisted region with AWS where all the NSA processing is done. I'm pretty sure they're pretty locked down there, you know, and know what they're doing. DoD is the same. So for the FDA to come around, you know, there's really, I think, a broad recognition when we talk to people who are current regulators and former regulators. And actually, a lot of this work is being done at their request of saying, we need a way to judge what quality is when we do this in the cloud. We fundamentally, as one person who's pretty savvy and as a former regulator said to me, even if a medical device maker makes no contingency plans for outages in the cloud, the device is still probably better off than it was if it was an in-house data center from the medical device company. It's still probably better run, even with that, if you've done nothing. I'd be happy just with that. But that said, it's still better off if you architect and design for this sort of indirect control model.
You mentioned a body that's helping with this advancement. I think you called it AIMI.
Yep.
I'm curious to what degree they've updated and embraced, and the regulations have updated and embraced the cloud and multi-tenant operations and those kinds of things. Because I know when I was heavily involved in some like PCI DSS stuff several years ago, the rules hadn't really been updated to accommodate the cloud. So the assumption was everything was kind of being hosted on premises. And then to get the regulators to give you the rubber stamp, you had to justify that it was okay in the cloud. Has that thinking or the regulations changed to accommodate cloud operations?
Thinking has absolutely changed. I will tell you, mileage will vary. Like with any organization, you know, there's several hundred individual people who approve applications. There's thousands of different, you know, people who come out and do audits. So mileage will vary, but absolutely, I think there's a broad appreciation that this stuff makes sense and is good. Have the regulations changed? They're getting there. In fact, this is part of it. There's actually an interesting process. Once Congress makes a law and you need to fill out the details, right? You know, with the regulations, there's sort of two ways at a high level this can happen, as I understand it, at least in the US. The government can write its own document, you know, with some detailed regulations and put it out, which can be fine, but it can take a very long time because these things are big and they're hard and they're difficult. Or the government can say to industry, you know what, you write a document under one of these standards bodies, and if we like it, we'll vote on it and essentially say, we're outsourcing to this document. This document is how we will regulate according to this. And it may be that we will require you to do what's required if it's a standard, or if it's more of a pre-standard document, like which the stage we're at, we'll say that's a best practice. You may be other ways, but if you come to us and say, I'm following AIMI Technical Information Report 115, we'll say, okay, good. We've all agreed that's the way to do it.
When you say best practices, it makes me shiver a little bit because I have seen things that were best practices from, you know, a decade ago that are still in documents, even though the common knowledge and the actual best practices have moved on since then. Like the idea of rotating your password every 30 days or something, like we know that's a terrible idea, but I still find that in like every security document for organizations.
Well, it's funny, you did something stunning because these standards efforts, a lot of them are designed to be really long lasting. I mean, some of these standards we use are now in versions, but they go back, you know, a couple decades. And I think we've really struggled and put some extra time into how do we make this so that it's not so specific to quarter one of 2024's technologies by the time it comes out, it's but it's not so tremendously high level and abstracted that you look at it and be like, oh, well, this is nice in theory, but I have no idea what to do with it.
I was going to say, I deal with a lot of customers in this space. The regulations haven't been updated for a long time. And this industry is naturally risk averse. I mean, when you make a change to grandma's pacemaker, natural risk aversion to certain aspects and new technologies, which is why you see all of these old practices, you know, documented. But the regulations themselves don't preclude cloud. I mean, they don't mandate technologies. They don't actually mandate specific practices. They simply encourage best practices. And that's an interesting dynamic because, you know, everything is typically locked down in a quality management system. It's very, you know, structured. Customers don't typically want to change, even though, you know, they have to operate under quality management systems, which encourages continuous improvement, you know, these cycles, but you just don't see it. So it's an interesting dynamic in the industry where regulations haven't changed, but it doesn't preclude new technologies. The industry wants to use technologies, but until the agencies say yes, they're kind of reluctant to do it. So there's all these things kind of vying and putting pressure on the industry. And, you know, the AMI TIR that we're working on is trying to unblock that, just to provide some clarity to the industry going, yes, you can use cloud for these use cases. And, you know, here's how to go about it. How, you know, you must consider the risk still. All the same regulations apply. But it's trying to kind of just unblock slightly that hesitancy or lack of clarity in the industry. Like, can we use cloud technology?
I think everybody's really trying to do the right thing. If anything, I have to say, I've been blown away at the forward thinking of the regulators we work with. And how much they really do want to see change. They're just trying to make sure, A, they do it responsibly and well, and B, they're doing it when they're just tremendously under-resourced, right? So they can't put into place things, the regulations that they don't have the manpower to oversee. And they have to make sure that whatever they're putting in isn't going to disrupt the whole industry and bring things to a halt. You know, if you work for the government, you know, and you're regulating medical device, you get hauled before Congress and yelled at for two things. One, hey, FDA, you let an unsafe device onto the market. It wasn't ready. It was, you know, snake oil, or it was low quality, and it harmed my constituent. And the other thing they'll get yelled at is, hey, FDA, I have this constituent who's this brilliant medical entrepreneur and has this amazing new device. Why are you slowing down and keeping them from bringing this revolutionary thing to the market?
Right. Two different pressures there. I recently listened to an audiobook called Recoding America that was recommended to us by friend of the show, Chris Wall. And it talked about implementation versus the regulation and how you shouldn't have the implementation details in the regulation, because that can lead to that exact problem. Well, you said I have to do it this way and it's in the regulation, instead of this is what we want you to accomplish. How you actually do that, that's an implementation detail.
And like Ian said, there's a lot of flexibility. Sometimes it's more cultural. You know, it's a habit of, no, we can't do that. Why? Because we've never done it that way. The regulations say it. And you go and dig up the regulations and go, no, actually, they really don't say that. We had this debate 10, 15 years ago about bringing agile methods as opposed to waterfall, because this industry, for very good reasons, was a waterfall industry. First of all, it was not a computer industry to start out. You know, you're talking about all kinds of other engineering methods where waterfall did help encourage safety. It just isn't very flexible in a highly agile world. Our argument is that those methods had their time. And today, the newer methods, because they embrace change, are actually fundamentally better for safety and effectiveness. But it's an adjustment.
And that was a good example, because the FDA ultimately came out with guidance saying, you know what, we prefer agile. We see the benefits. And they actually issued guidance saying, no, we prefer agile. I think this was for medical devices. So we're trying to get them to do the same. No, say, we love cloud.
Maximize cloud efficiency with Doit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Doit's innovative tools, expert insights, and smart technology make optimization simple. Elevate your cloud strategy and simplify your cloud spend. Visit Doit.com. That's Doit.com. Doit, your cloud simplified.
I swear, with the number of documents I've created that have pictures of the AWS UI and it says, click here to do this, click here to do that. And it's changed now in the last, you know, 6 months. So yeah, those implementation details are a moving target, as it were.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're not the only industry. These are all fall under sort of this classification of safety critical industries, which also, by the way, tend to be your more regulated industries. You can think about automotive, traffic, air control, major utilities. These are all places where you don't want to just slam code it. And they all, to some extent, I am not an expert on it, but they all have different levels of government regulation on how you make updates. I think in some ways, medical device may just be the most high profile one, because it's the one that's most in our face every day.
Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear more about the actual devices that you're deploying, and how do they leverage AWS? Like, what do the architectures look like that you're using? I've worked in lots of different industries in the past, and it's all like web-based stuff, and it all looks really similar. It's S3 buckets and Lambda and load balancers and CloudFront. So I would love to hear, like, is it different? Is it the same? What's it look like?
Fundamentally, it's very similar. You think about the use case. So let's take a connected medical device. You know, there's a big push, you know, especially in the US, to encourage connected care. So moving outside the boundaries of the hospital. So monitoring patients in home settings, these kinds of things, which is going to require medical devices outside hospital settings connected in some fashion. So you have this physical device. Let's just say, you know, blood pressure cuff or heart rate monitor. You're sitting at home. It's connecting to your local Wi-Fi, maybe going through a gateway or your phone over Bluetooth. It's using IoT technology to stream data to the cloud. It's capturing that data, you ingest that data, and then the use cases are endless. I mean, you put it in your data lake, you build machine learning models on top of that data, which do some cool stuff to, you know, predict maybe some adverse event that's coming up. Who knows? Use cases are endless. But fundamentally, the architecture is pretty standard. You'll see similar IoT architectures in connected cars or connected factories. You know, when there's connectivity, a lot of times the architecture is very similar, which is often a good thing. I mean, these are tried, true, tested architectures across industries. AWS web services, they're designed fairly industry agnostic. It's how you use them. It's the use cases that you implement using them. And in this kind of situation with medical devices, the fairly standard architectural building blocks get used again and again in these different scenarios.
Yeah, you just design for more resilience if you're less tolerant. And at a certain point, think of it almost like an edge computing model. There are certain functions of certain medical devices that should never be moved off the physical device because Bluetooth connection lost or internet down or something like that is just not acceptable. So a couple examples I'll give you. There are a lot of devices that talk to the cloud, but only for certain functions. So if you have a wearable defibrillator, that's a new thing. You know, if you go in for surgery and you're under general anesthesia, they're essentially, the anesthesia is bringing your body pretty close to death, you know, to calm it down for the surgery. Mm-hmm. The 30 days afterwards, you're more likely to have a heart attack because you've kind of messed with the heart a bit. So what people do, they have these wearable defibrillators. So you walk around with them and it essentially diagnoses you're having a heart attack and it can administer a shock to you. I guarantee you with those devices, they're sending data back to the cloud. They're monitoring you long-term. They're updating your doctor. They're probably training to continually improve their diagnosis and learn different kind of subtypes of different hearts. But the actual decision of like, oh, no, Randy's having a heart attack right now. Clear, zap. You're not going to move that off the firmware and the embedded. You're going to keep that local. Same thing in, you know, like think about like glucose monitors and insulin pumps. So, you know, all that data is coming back because you can monitor trends with people self-managing their diabetes and keeping themselves in this very specific lane of where you want your numbers to be for the rest of your life to protect your body. Mm-hmm. However, there's the newest class sort of that's coming out of these devices, what's called closed loop, where the essentially the pump and the monitor talk to each other and automatically adjust and just give you the exact amount of insulin you need at any given moment, as opposed to you measuring going, oh, okay, here's how much I have to inject with my pen, or here's what I put my setting to. So you'll do a lot of background notification to your doctors and learning about the patient in the cloud. But that actual closed loop decision-making process of like, wow, your glucose just spiked. We've got to do something. That's going to stay resident on the device locally.
Aside from faults, one of the biggest concerns I would have around these devices is security. And I would say, like, with the IoT, the S is for security, right? It was not baked into the idea initially. So I'm curious, like, how are you implementing security on the devices and on the AWS side to ensure that the devices aren't going to get hacked or no one's snooping on the information that's being transmitted up to the cloud?
And again, this is, you know, a shared responsibility. So we're ensuring the security of the cloud itself. You have to ensure the security of your workload in the cloud. So, you know, we provide services where you can encrypt in transit, encrypt at rest to the level of encryption that you want, you know, according to your requirements. If you choose not to do that, then well, that's on you. So we're providing these abilities. The services have this ability to, you know, encrypt that traffic end to end from device all the way through to, you know, the back end. So you have the SDK on the device itself, talking IoT, MQTT protocol over the IoT services that can all be encrypted to the back end. It's encrypted at rest. You have that ability. It's up to the device manufacturer then to take full advantage of that. cybersecurity is an extremely hot topic around the FDA and other agencies right now. You know, this ability to hack in to your device, a lot of it is actually focused on the edge of the device itself. So, you know, man in the middle of your Bluetooth connection between the device and your phone. As part of device design, you have to look at these attack vectors. You have to do that threat analysis. You have to consider these as risks. And how is your architecture mitigating those risks? How are you going to combat any kind of hacking attempt on these things? You know, and we help customers look at this. You know, we'll do well-architected reviews. We'll, you know, look at the security from our perspective. So it really is a shared responsibility that this thing become, you know, as bulletproof as possible.
And like we said, this is not a new issue, but the cloud has put it on steroids. So let me take you back 15, 20 years, where you would have seen software in a medical device. You go to your doctor's clinic and they have you use a spirometer, right, to measure your breathing function. And that's attached to a Windows PC with a Windows app running on it. And the person, you know, clicks, they say, okay, enter. Okay, now breathe, right? You know, and you watch the things go up and down. Do you remember the old days when somebody used to install their own screen saving program on Windows and it would like grind it to a halt, or once in a while they'd actually have to rebuild the entire PC because of the screensaver? Or picture those old client server apps where if the computer slowed down so much, you could literally watch the code execute and as it like filled in each field and populated and manually moved the cursor and Power Builder. Okay, so that's timing. Spirometers are all about timing. Who knows if that threw off the measurements of, you know, your pressure versus per second kind of a thing, and you know, these sort of waveform readings. So this is not brand new. It's just a lot more in your face than it used to be, I guess.
It's absolutely critical. If my watch drips or my clock drips, I don't really care as long as I stay on my like domain and my authentication works. Right. But for, you know, something that's so critical with timing, I've tried to read into hardware level timings and it just makes my head spin. It is so much more complicated than you can imagine.
Yeah. I used to have an alarm clock at home with a house that probably was not totally wired properly. And when I printed a lot, the clock would slow down a minute or two over time. Because you could see the lights kind of dip. I was like, oh, it's messing with the clock speed. Interesting.
Interesting. Literally the clock speed. I like that. It's full of puns today.
I don't know why I know this, but yeah, the frequency of the electricity coming into your home is highly regulated by the power companies. And so clocks can use that for how they keep time with their crystal. So yeah, Randy, that's exactly what was going on. Something was messing with that frequency. It's about 60 hertz, I think. And if that frequency gets off by a little bit, it can just kind of throw everything off. That's wild that you notice that correlation between the two things. I did want to ask, because Ian, you briefly mentioned that AWS has the well-architected framework and some guidance. Do you have specific guidance around architectures for regulated devices, or sort of like pre-built environments you can deploy with CloudFormation or something if you're going to be building something for this field?
In a way. So, I mean, I always, you know, go back to regulations and how they basically are asking you to implement best practices, which, you know, I can interpret from my angle as an architect as, you know, what are my best practices when it comes to my architecture? What is, you know, my cloud-based architecture? And that's where the well-architected framework fits squarely. It's like, if you are going to build a connected device or software as a medical device, it should be well-architected. A lot of like the architectures, as I mentioned, you know, connected device, it's a fairly standard architecture using IoT services, not much different between medical device or a connected car or your coffee machine. It's the same basic technical architecture. So although it's operating in a regulated environment from a technology perspective for the technologists, it's not much different from an architecture perspective. What often is the difference is the rigor and the process around you building and designing and testing all of these things. But fundamentally, the technology is the same. And yeah, we have reference architectures for IoMT, as we call it, so Internet of Medical Things. Oh. We have various different architectures, reference architectures, based on the variability, the type of device, the location of the device. Is it at home? In hospital setting, the pharmacy, where is it? What kind of connectivity do you have? What kind of payload is coming across this connection? Is it, you know, high, large volume, low frequency, like medical imaging? Is it high frequency, low volume, like heart rate monitor, and everything in between? So we can tweak the architecture, these reference architectures, based on your particular use case, and come up with a well-architected architecture for that particular device scenario. So yeah, we're working a lot with customers. You know, a lot of the time, you know, we try and take this heavy lifting off our customers. So we try and come up with these reference architectures or out-of-the-box implementations to try and make this a lot easier for the industry.
One of the wake-up moments for me was I said to Ian, hey, Ian, when we publish this thing, which we keep saying will be next quarter, but it's taken a while. It's been a real beast. Wouldn't it be great if AWS could come out with a document, all the cloud providers, that says, okay, yeah, we endorse Technical Information Report 115. We think this is good stuff. And by the way, here's in Q2 of 2024, a good way to implement it in AWS. And Ian's responses to me, it was really kind of opened my eyes, was, yeah, we can do that. But more or less, it's just refer to all of our other documents about doing a good architecture and good design. There's nothing revolutionary. And that's the good news is, you know, if you're following good software engineering practices, CI/CD, regression testing, testing automation, you know, resiliency to the appropriate level, you're kind of 85% of the way there already.
Let's talk about that. So CI/CD is building and unit testing your code before you deploy it to the next environment. I'm very familiar with that. We have like 6 environments at work. And when you introduce code, it's always at the bottom. You roll it up, you unit test it, you smoke test it. But these are hardware devices. Are there virtualized versions of these devices that you test on? Or do you have like a fleet of hardware in a room somewhere, like little Raspberry Pis running this software? How do you test all this stuff and make sure that, you know, grandma's pacemaker is safe when it gets to prod?
Yes, yes, and yes. So some of what you're getting to is actually being the hardware engineer on a proprietary physical hardware device, you know, which could have a generic chip, a multi-purpose one, or could have a printed circuit board. That's not my area of expertise. It's generally not Ian's, I don't think, unless you've got a secret background I don't know about. But I can tell you there's a lot of things you do. I mean, one of the ones you do is you simply, when you're building the connected software side, you know, the sort of the thing that catches it on the smartphone or the cloud, you build a simulator for the medical device itself that's a piece of software that simulates the hardware, which is also really good because then you don't have to wait for the hardware team to finish their hardware. It's also good because then it forces you to put all the behaviors into a specification that you code to. And then when the actual device appears, if something's off and it doesn't work between the simulator and the device, it's either, okay, so we got something wrong in the simulator, or we missed a requirement. You know, we missed an angle. So there are, you know, you can do simulators. If you're doing it with smartphones and you need to test, you know, the sort of 80,000 variants, literally, of smartphones in use in the US, there are these remote farms you can connect to. I do know that some of, you know, for instance, the major players in sort of consumerized things like a glucose monitor, they keep a whole mess of smartphones around and they have a whole system for testing on each one. We looked a couple of years ago at these sort of micro robots you could program to essentially simulate a human's hand and just kind of keep cycling from through. It was, I think it's got great potential. It was a little bit early and it ended up being a whole lot of infrastructure would have to get built out to do it. So if you were doing it for every device, you could probably make a go of it, but it was sort of a little early. But there are, you know, server farm services you can use with just rows of smartphones back there, rows of emulated operating systems that you can work.
You can use ours. So we have AWS Device Farm, which is geared specifically for this kind of use case where you can spin up, you know, different device types, different browsers, you know, you name it, and you do your testing through Device Farm.
That is totally new to me. I thought you were going to introduce Mechanical Turk. If we want to put up, you know, different smartphones, check in, people do work for a dollar.
We had actually talked about if we spun up a service off of the robots that we would still need a Mechanical Turk to go and literally physically pull one smartphone out of the holder, you know, and another smartphone in at midnight or 1 a.m.
That's wild. Just emulating the taps that a human would do.
Where it gets more complicated is when you have a physical connection. If you actually need to test, you know, Bluetooth connections under different situations, then it gets more interesting because now you have to be able to simulate different physical environments of, you know, I'm in the sub basement or there's 275 other Bluetooth connections. And now you're getting into sort of the world of physical test labs that have very sophisticated equipment that's purpose built for all these kind of crazy edge scenarios.
But a lot of testing, I mean, user experience is another hot topic in the device industry. And that dovetails in with this kind of testing by being able to test your device in different geographical locations. So does the device actually perform the same if it's in the US or Europe, for example? So this ability to actually not only automate and run your tests, but to do it in different locations is another dimension. And again, you know, because cloud providers have these different regions across the globe, it's starting to enable much easier testing with these geographical aspects built in.
Interesting, because as far as the cloud services, as far as AWS is concerned, you have a level of consistency across all of your data centers. in terms of services, the way the data center works. But when you move outside of the data center, you start getting into the implementation details of a given geography. Well, they might use a slightly different cell service. They might implement their electricity a little bit differently, different voltages, different amperages, different frequencies that are being modulated. There's a lot of variance in there that if I'm testing a device that has to work out in the wild, I have to test all this weird stuff.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, so if you're remaining on the AWS backbone and leveraging that worldwide connectivity, yeah, there's a certain level of consistency. Once you're out in the wild, you know, there's a significant distance between your actual end user in home connecting over their dodgy local Wi-Fi or cell service to the nearest access point that then gets you onto the back end and the cloud.
Bring that back to even a medical device that is solely software and solely lives in the cloud. Early on, we did some interviews to understand how manufacturers were looking at this. And one of them, they have an algorithm that looks in an MRI and does some very sophisticated calculations on it. I don't remember if it's to diagnose something or to do some measurements or to look change across them. But they said, oh, it's amazing. You know, in the old days, people downloaded software and then you had to have different versions. And when you pushed out an update, you know, somebody had to go around with a CD-ROM and did they have the right version? All this. They said, now it's literally just one code base. Every specification for a different country and how they practice healthcare, what their laws are, that's all just programmed in. That's architected in. You have switches and you say, oh, no, this is France. This is the Germany rule. This is the US rule. And we have one instance and one code base. And that was fantastic. Until the day we rolled out a feature that took advantage of our CSP, a new feature from our CSP that was going to do some great new functionality. And it turned out that the Australian New Zealand region did not yet support that feature. And that's something that was publicly available to us. It's just never something we had thought to look at before. And all of a sudden, we had a device which was only capable of running in one instance globally, and we couldn't run it in globally.
This is a little bit of a left turn, but I'm so curious about it. I can't wait to ask. So you talked earlier about this is non-hardware AI models that you treat as medical devices. In my own business, we have been told you can use like programming assistants like Copilot to help you write code, but you have to confirm it. You need to sign your name that it's right. And if you're doing anything with diagnostics, we need to talk to the legal team. So I'm curious, for your business, for regulations, are they keeping up with how quickly AI is now developing? Because I cannot imagine they are, because I'm not keeping up with how quickly it's developing.
They're playing catch up. So Randy mentioned the FDA, and I think they're one of the more progressive agencies. They are trying to keep pace with this technological advancement, especially around ML. They have issued discussion papers around, this is how we're thinking about regulating machine learning for these regulated devices, software as a medical device. But they're collaborating with industry. So I think that it's really nice that they're acknowledging that they don't have all the answers, and they are, you know, leveraging industry experience on actually helping define how the regulations will pan out. And in that particular case, it's interesting. So usually you test a device, it becomes validated when it passes all of its tests and it's released. ML is slightly different because models can learn over time. Now, with the old regulations, that would have meant that you build this machine learning model for whatever particular use case, you get it approved in the market. If you retrain, you would have to submit again and get it reapproved by the FDA. That's going to slow everything down. So to their credit, I mean, the US government introduced this, and then this was added into law recently, this concept of predetermined change control plans. So you can include in your submission to the FDA a description of what changes you anticipate being made, how you will deal with those changes, how those changes are controlled, which then enables you to then implement those changes post-market, so once it's actually released. So they're working with industry, they're understanding these different dynamics that are unique to machine learning models and trying to incorporate that into law and regulations. So all credit to them.
If you look at the whole shift left concept in engineering, it's shifting left with regulatory as well. It's saying, how can we get more confidence in your process and agree on guardrails that give you more latitude to bring things to patients sooner, with us being comfortable that, you know, we're not just slamming stuff in and it's not a free rein to do anything anybody wants.
Totally. Safe and fast, if such a thing is possible.
Move faster and break nothing.
That's a good tagline.
Yeah, indeed. A lot of what you're talking about is more process than it is technology. And a lot of our listeners are not going to be in regulated industry. They're not dealing with this level of oversight. But I'm guessing there's some key takeaways or some lessons learned that they can also take advantage of in their day-to-day practice. Randy, is there anything that jumps out to you that someone in a non-regulated industry could take from your experience?
I'm glad you asked. Yes. So the downside of this stuff is it slows everything down. There's more overhead, there's more process, and sometimes that's a real pain, and sometimes it slows things down. There are some tools and techniques, though, that I think could be useful. The big one is we say everything's a risk-based approach, which means you don't just approach things in terms of what functionality can you do. Every time you make a change, you look at what could go wrong in a very systemic, methodic way, and you're really comprehensive in that. So I would say anybody who's got a system that you really want to make sure is up or you really want to make sure is accurate could benefit from looking at some of these risk-based tools. Kind of the two key ones I'll just describe at a high level are when you do a risk-based analysis of what can go wrong, there's sort of a top-down and a bottom-up approach. The top-down approach is I have this feature. This feature is important. If it fails, X would happen. What are all these things that could cause that feature to fail? Let's look under the hood at the technology and the infrastructure and see what could go wrong. The other one is to look at every piece of technology out there and go, what could go wrong? And if it went wrong, what feature could it impact? You know, and I think a lot of this probably sounds pretty similar to the episode you had very recently on chaos engineering. You know, where are all the places things can go wrong? And can I mess with the dials now? This, I would argue, is I haven't worked with it personally matching up chaos engineering to these tools, but I would guess there's probably a pretty good fit of a way to be really comprehensive if you're doing something like that.
And I would say, I think the regulations, it's, again, an interesting dynamic. Like they're asking you to follow best practices and for the moment prove that you are following best practices. You know, and I always, you know, have this in my mind. It's like, if you're a software engineering team and your objective is to be mediocre, well, then you should be fired. I mean, every good engineering team is striving to, you know, release code with zero defects. You know, it works, it's resilient, et cetera, et cetera. Regulation is almost a forcing factor to make sure that you are doing those exact things. So what it's doing is, you know, we have to implement certain things like very rigorous testing, you know, multiple release stages in our release pipelines. Testing in production, which is very new to this industry. But the fact that testing can be automated to a huge extent now, it used to be a blocker because it was a cost. You know, manual testing, it takes a long time, it slows you down, manpower has cost, etc. With automated testing, with the ability to use CI/CD pipelining, with infrastructure as code, all of these things are coming together and they're driving the cost of testing towards zero. I mean, it's not entirely zero, but it's driving the cost of that to zero. So these best practices are now available to any industry. You know, you can automate your pipelines, you can have pre-deployment checks with, you know, CloudFormation hooks, NAGs, you know, all of these different checks, post-deployment checks. The cloud services are now driving you towards a more of a continuous compliance stance, because if any configuration changes and it drops out of compliance, you're alerted immediately. You can even automate that remediation to fix it and put it back. All of these new techniques really should be used by everybody. Regulations are forcing this industry to do a lot of this, but it's just best practice. You should be doing this anyway. You should be striving to be, you know, a kick-ass software engineering team.
That makes perfect sense to me. And I think that's a great note to end out on. Randy, if people want to know more about you, want to follow what you're doing or what Orthogonal's doing out there, where are some good places to find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You cannot find me on X. I'm quite active on LinkedIn. We also have Orthogonal's blog where we put out a lot of thought leadership on these topics, including interviews with people like Ian.
Awesome. Ian, same question.
Yeah, I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm also fairly regularly pushing out blog posts or authoring white papers from AWS. So that'll all be on the AWS websites.
And I'll offer a challenge. If you find me on MySpace, I'll give you a 1-hour free consult on this topic.
Oh, I think the only thing on MySpace now is music. So that implies you have a band, Randy. Well, Randy and Ian, thank you so much for appearing on today's episode of Day 2 Cloud. And hey, listeners, thanks to you for making it all the way to the end, you outstanding human you. Virtual high fives. For more fine infrastructure engineering conversations just like this, visit packetpushers.net. We're offering several other highly technical podcast series, along with newsletters, a Slack community, an engineering blog, and more. It's all free and ungated content for your professional career development. You can follow me and Kyler on LinkedIn, where we post nerdy things for IT pros such as you. And you can find us. The names are Ned Belavance and Kyler Middleton. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.